Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Nathan Bierma. As Americans gather for Thanksgiving this week, we may assume that we're continuing an unbroken chain of tradition that traces directly back to the Pilgrims in 1620. In fact, many of our most cherished Thanksgiving traditions are far more recent, and some are at odds with the historical record. When you examine various American traditions through the eyes of a historian and cultural critic, the gap between myth and fact can be vast. But that gap is instructive in revealing what Americans believe about ourselves. This is what Jack David Eller contends in his new book, Inventing American Tradition, From the Mayflower to Cinco de Mayo, new this month from Reaction Books. I asked Eller how fact-checking history helps show what we think it means to be American. Joining me now is Jack David Eller, author of Inventing American Tradition. David, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
My great pleasure to be with you this morning.
So you're an anthropologist. You've done various works on American anthropology, cultural anthropology. Explain how you set your sights on Thanksgiving and other American traditions.
Well, when I was teaching my introductory cultural anthropology class, I would use American traditions as, you know, examples of cultural change processes. So I had researched Thanksgiving. I would usually do Thanksgiving in the fall and sometimes Easter in the spring. And began to realize there was a whole set of stories there that Americans really don't know, and that not only are kind of amusing and entertaining, but really shed some interesting light on American culture and history.
Did you find your students were generally quite surprised to learn about these stories?
Oh, yes, most definitely. They were surprised how recently a lot of these traditions had begun, and then how much they had changed over time, and really how much disagreement there has been, and in a lot of cases, you know, continues to be about, you know, fairly cherished American traditions.
Yeah, it was continually striking going through this book to say, well, it's only this old. It's not as old as you think. So as we gather for Thanksgiving this week, we think that we're continuing the tradition that was started when the Pilgrims all gathered on Thanksgiving, the fourth Thursday of November in 1620, and ate turkey, and that it's been an American holiday ever since. And almost none of that is true or fully true. So let's start with the Mayflower. You point out, you ask, who was on the Mayflower? It wasn't all pious pilgrims looking to practice their religion freely. Who else was on the Mayflower?
Well, about half of the crew, I guess, or the passengers, were, you know, pilgrims, quote unquote, that is kind of extremist Protestants who just couldn't get along in, you know, more kind of religiously plural Europe. So they were just escaping from that. And the rest of them were fortune seekers, servants. There were a few indentured servants. And the entire project, as I mentioned in the book, was actually financed by a company, the Plymouth Company in England, that was not at all interested in religious freedom. They were interested in making money. And so they were just looking to hire a bunch of settlers who would go to America and start a little business colony and make money for the company.
And if they had intended to start a major cultural festival on Thanksgiving, you point out that the last people who would have celebrated it on a regular or substantial basis would have been the Pilgrims, because they were opposed to big cultural celebrations like that. They even opposed Christmas for a while, so they wouldn't have been on board with the plan as we've carried it out in modern times.
No, one, giving thanks was a fairly common thing, so they didn't think they were doing anything particularly special that day. And as you say, not only kind of cultural celebrations, but especially religious kind of things like this, kind of compelling God on the same day every year would have been verging on blasphemous to them.
So there is a record of a harvest festival that took place in 1620, I believe in Plymouth. What is this record? What do we know about what happened and what didn't happen?
Well, we know fairly little. We know that there was a thankful day, and again, it was a fairly common thing, not only for pilgrims, but Christians in general, to declare days of thanks, whether it was a saint's day or, you know, success in a battle or, you know, almost anything that they could be thankful for. And obviously, in this case, they were thankful that about half of them had survived the winter. And so they had a rather typical, you know, kind of harvest festival. Most farming cultures do have some kind of end of the fall festival when, you know, the food is finally available. We have some sense of what they might have eaten just based on what was available at the time. So they probably ate some fowl of various kinds, probably also a lot of seafood, obviously, on the Massachusetts coast. Things they would not have eaten would include potatoes, because there were no potatoes in North America, any kind of pies, because they had no sugar and they used up all their flour, any kind of dairy, because they brought no cows with them, no apples, because there were no apples indigenous to North America. So, and of course, you might have noticed last week or so, the woman who invented the green bean casserole died, and she had only invented it like in the 50s or 60s. So there were no green bean casseroles, obviously, at the first Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I've eaten that and thought that that was what the pilgrims did 400 years ago, but that's pretty recent itself. And there was no turkey, or probably not turkey. When they talk about eating fowl and deer, was there turkey?
Mm-hmm. There may have been some turkey, because turkeys were indigenous to the continent, but they probably would have also eaten goose and duck, deer, as I mentioned, things like that. But turkey was not the centerpiece by any means whatsoever. That was invented probably 200 years later.
And so then you trace how there are various days of Thanksgiving for various purposes that occur throughout American history, being declared on days that include June 30, February 19, January 12, May 9, all over the place. The date gets settled much later. But you write that as Thanksgiving and the proclamation of an American Thanksgiving by the president, which I believe first happened, well, I should say George Washington declared one, right? And then Abraham Lincoln settled it later. But it wasn't connected to, at least explicitly, to the settlement at Plymouth and the celebration in 1620.
Well, most definitely. Yeah, the declarations, the proclamations by Washington and Adams had nothing to do with the pilgrims whatsoever. They were usually days about, you know, again, battles that had been won usually. And even Lincoln's proclamation in 1863 never mentions the pilgrims specifically. That's obviously about, first of all, it was about, I don't know if we want to talk about Sarah Josepha Hale and her role in all of this, but it was roughly just to declare a day when the Americans, which we mean, you know, the Union Americans, the Northern Americans, could kind of come together right in the middle of the heat of the Civil War. But at no point does it reference the pilgrims.
And there was even, you write about, some hostility or suspicion to celebrating Thanksgiving outside New England because it was a regional practice and other regions didn't want to adopt what they saw as a New England practice. Is that right?
Absolutely. Thanksgiving, as we know it, was a New England, Massachusetts regional tradition, and other states had either their own traditions or nothing at all in that regard. And obviously during the Civil War, the South, you know, washed their hands of it completely. That was a Yankee tradition with which they had nothing to do at all.
So in 1905, the first explicit connection to the settlement at Plymouth is made in a presidential proclamation, not until the 20th century. That's where my jaw dropped. And you write that there were two strands of history that eventually got tied together. One is some sort of harvest festival that did occur in 1620, and the other is this sense of a national American holiday as established in presidential proclamations. And the two ended up merging in the 20th century. Can you explain how that happened?
Well, that's kind of a story that emerges, I think, throughout the traditions that I discuss in the book. And this was kind of a surprise to me, because I kind of imagined the book at first to be this kind of light, amusing study of American traditions. And I began to notice that what you know, I and what we social scientists call traditioning was happening a lot in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And that had a lot to do with, of course, the trauma of the Civil War that had just occurred. And then the perceived threats to American identity and unity through immigration and the supposed, you know, threat of the working class and socialism. And so there became this real kind of, you know, energy, this machine to create American traditions to pull people together. So we see that especially in this Thanksgiving, as you say, this kind of these two strands coming together, both creating this kind of, you know, unified American activity and celebrating American identity and hearkening back to a kind of a romanticized, to say it, you know, kindly, memory of, you know, the very earliest days of Europeans on American soil, and trying to then connect that as if there's some continuous, you know, unbroken line between what happened in the early 1600s and in the early 1900s.
So you have a fascinating quote on this. Let me read it. Quote, "As the true epitome of an invented tradition, Thanksgiving emerged out of colonial practices, took on many forms, adapted to each historical moment, and eventually wrapped back around itself to link the present with a selected and imagined moment in the past." And as you just said, there's also this conflicted feeling about the fact that when we celebrate the Plymouth settlers in any respect, what we're celebrating is something that ended up displacing native populations on this continent. And you even refer to Thanksgiving as, quote, a collective conscience washing. And so, as you say, this invented tradition helps forge a sense of unity. But with this very deeply conflicted reality that we're also talking about massive displacement and oppression of native peoples and throughout American history of other minorities.
Absolutely. Not only is it a day of national unity, but it, as you're saying, the past, but it also, you know, creates this idea of a benevolent American past that, you know, the pilgrims and the Indians were hugging each other and, you know, so happy to be, you know, living together. And so to overlook and kind of, you know, forget the displacement, but we forget that it was only a few years after, you know, this first Thanksgiving that literally wars broke out between the colonists and the Indians. And so any kind of, you know, benevolent feelings, you know, between those two groups ended very quickly. And we tend to, as you say, skip over all of that. So we connect 1620 and any happy moments to the present, which, you know, serves fine for mainstream, you know, white American memory. But as I mentioned at the end of the book, there are other people in America who do not remember Thanksgiving anywhere nearly as pleasantly.
And this is true in many of the patriotic traditions that you also trace. And let's talk about some of them. The national anthem, for instance, the national anthem that was played and used in George Washington's inauguration was not the Star Spangled Banner, which had not been written yet, but was a song called Hail Columbia. Columbia being the name for America as it was assumed to have been discovered by Columbus. Although, as you say, when you talk about Columbus Day, Columbus had never set foot on what became the United States. So tell us about how Hail Columbia was for a long time a viable contender to be our national anthem.
Certainly. Well, of course, you know, the Constitution specifies no anthem, and America got along for, you know, many decades without an anthem. Hail Columbia was written specifically for Washington and wasn't intended to be an anthem. It was more sort of a fanfare for the president, and interestingly, is still used today as sort of the fanfare for the vice president, equivalent to Hail to the Chief for the president. And Columbia, yeah, was a common name for America. And I don't know if we have time to talk about Uncle Sam today, but as I mentioned in the book, Columbia was also a pictured character, a woman who was often used to personify and visualize America. And it was only many years later that a poem that was set to a British song gradually became the national anthem.
Well, let's talk about that anthem, and then let's talk about Uncle Sam. One thing I didn't know, I knew that Francis Scott Key wrote it during the War of 1812. I didn't know that he was on a British ship during the attack on Fort McHenry. You write that he was admitted onto the ship to help negotiate or attempt to negotiate the release of an American prisoner, and he was watching this while being detained by the British while this played out. Tell us more about what he did and how this experience led to this text that became the words of our anthem.
Sure. Well, Key was a prominent citizen of Baltimore, and he was selected to, as you say, negotiate with the British for the release of another prominent citizen. So he happened to be aboard a ship in the Baltimore Harbor. and was told that he wouldn't be able to get off at the moment because they were going to start the attack on the really impregnable fort in Baltimore Harbor, Fort McHenry. And this bombardment went on for about 24 hours, as we well know from the song. It was unsuccessful, but Key was unable to leave, so he was a spectator from the British side as this bombardment went on. And the myth goes, at least, that in the morning when the fort was still standing and the flag was still flying, he pulled out a piece of paper and wrote down some verses of a poem, which has no title. It's not called The Star-Spangled Banner. But there is a notation that it would be sung to the tune of To Anacreon on Heaven, in Heaven rather, which is a famous and was really quite well known at the time, British social, some say even kind of drinking song.
Yeah, so we've got a battle with the British and the tune of a British drinking song. It's interesting that as the debate played out, as you trace it over what should the national anthem be, some of these skepticism or the reluctance to christen this song as the anthem is that the events were rather obscure, that the War of 1812 shouldn't rise to the occasion of being the event about which a national anthem is written. And there's also concerns raised about its musical qualities, how singable it is, both its words and its tune. And so this was not an easy course for this anthem to be adopted eventually as our national anthem.
No, it was quite a contentious thing. In fact, it was many decades after the words were set to music that it finally began to get some traction. In fact, quite possibly really, again, very, very early 1900s. There were many other contenders. In fact, there were actually contests held to try to create a national anthem, and nothing else seemed to stick. Hail Columbia was still a viable candidate throughout most of the 1800s. And as you say, there were people who thought that, first of all, a British drinking song was not suitable. We should have our own American melody. And many other verses, lyrics had been set to those same that same music, so it was hardly a unique thing. In fact, Key himself had written verses before the Star-Spangled Banner that he'd recommended to set to that same tune. Many people thought, as you say, it was too obscure. I mean, most Americans still today don't know actually what the song is about, that it's about that particular battle in that particular war. Most Americans know little about that war, honestly. Many thought that it was just too military a song, just too warlike. And others, and as we see today when people perform the song, the range of notes is really high, several octaves of music, and then the lyrics are very unusual. Most people don't realize that the first four lines of the first verse are all one long question. Oh, say, can you see? And then all these things, can you see? So the grammar is just very strange, and people actually don't even kind of recognize it. They just memorize random words rather than actually understanding what they're singing about.
Yeah, and you tie this back, as with all of these traditions, we talked about this conflicted conscience of America that's lying beneath the surface of all these traditions, and it's definitely come to the fore in recent years when we have NFL players and other athletes kneeling during the anthem to protest police brutality in this country, and the rebuke that they get, including from the president, is that they are protesting the anthem, and they're careful to clarify that, no, they're protesting police brutality, but it shows how high the stakes are in terms for many in terms of maintaining this tradition and what critics see as a slight to it.
Yes, in fact, as I mentioned in the book, Americans have never been particularly pious toward their national anthem. So it was used as a campaign song, over the years. It was used in advertising, protested during it long before, the current NFL protest I mentioned, and even have a photograph in the book of the Olympics protest. During the Black Power movement, when a couple of our athletes, raised their fists in a very similar kind of protest to what we see today. In fact, I refer to the singing, the performance of the Star-Spangled Banner and other things like that as sites of memory. And that's a common kind of social science way of thinking. And that means that people are kind of encouraged to think and remember and ponder at those moments, but exactly what they think. Exactly what they remember and feel at those moments varies tremendously. Same thing when the flag is displayed. Some people feel wonderfully patriotic, some are angry. And so on those special occasions, of course, people are going to express their particular visions and values of America. And those visions and values are not as unified as our traditions, you know, would make us think or would want us to be. And some people, whether it's, you know, African-Americans or Native Americans, are actually damned angry about a number of things. And that's when they express those feelings.
So do you find it, as contentious as these conflicts are, do you find it useful to have all of us sort of reexamine what is the anthem about, what are we saying, and what are the athletes saying when they kneel? Is that a useful exercise, as painful as it might feel for the country?
Not only useful, but inevitable, I think. Not only can we and must we do that, but I would go a step further and say that there isn't any one thing that the anthem means or that the flag means. They are symbols that we can fill with meaning. And as you know, the whole point of the book is that people have, first of all, had to create the symbols, and then they filled them with meaning very differently over time. And then even today, people obviously fill them quite differently with meaning. So the debate is not so much about what does the anthem or the flag really mean, as about how do different people see and think about it, and what does that mean for us as Americans who have to live together in some way.
Yeah, and to dwell on this for a second, there's also a sense, isn't there, that different groups are trying to take ownership and say, this is what it actually means. And even in slogans like Make America Great Again, what's great and what is America is defined in a certain way by a certain group. And in fact, that's all subjective and particular to a particular group's power and its own story. But doesn't it seem problematic that there are no absolutes, even though different groups seem to assume that their so-called ownership of a ritual or a symbol is absolute?
Oh, it's problematic. Right, for us anthropologists, much less so, because we, first of all, realize that everything in culture is constructed. You know, people have to create it. People have to, we say, contest it. And that whatever people, if they agree on anything at all today, it's through a very long historical, you know, process of beating out that meaning. But as much as it's constructed, it's also very, very pluralistic. That anything you can name, people are going to have two or more different attitudes or conclusions about it. Yeah. Not only over time, but in the present, of course.
Yeah. Well, this illustrates how, you know, it may start like, as you said, it seems like we're starting with sort of trivial fact-checking about some of these stories, and very, very quickly we get into these very deeply embedded themes and these questions about how a culture constitutes itself and sees itself. Let's talk about some of these other patriotic symbols that you have in your section on patriotic traditions. You mentioned Uncle Sam. Columbia, a female figure, was another contender to be sort of the personification of the country. And there was John Bull, or was John Bull British? Remind me. Help me sort out those figures.
John Bull's British brother, Jonathan, was the American equivalent. Yeah, so John Bull, there was already a tradition of depicting England as a person, John Bull. And so Americans, you know, developed this character, Brother Jonathan, who was sort of the younger brother or son or something of John Bull. And so we see very early on, even in the late 1700s, depictions of a Brother Jonathan of America interacting with John Bull and then later with Napoleon and other characters. And he was actually well-known and fairly popular on into the mid-1800s, even after the Uncle Sam character had been created. Most Americans, in fact, this is one point I make about the book, there are also traditions that have failed or traditions that we've forgotten, and Brother Jonathan is one of those.
So how did Uncle Sam triumph as the figure of America?
Well, there is supposedly, again, all this stuff is steeped in mythology, but there seems to be a possibility that there really was a Sam. He would have been Sam Wilson, who was once again a player in the War of 1812. He was a food supplier, a meat packer, and he stamped his crates with a U.S., which some people thought was, you know, actually, it's an interesting side point. The idea of U.S. as an abbreviation for the United States was fairly uncommon at that time. So people didn't know if it meant United States or referred to Sam himself. And so his employees, who called him Uncle Sam, started joking that this U.S. meant Uncle Sam. That was picked up and spread by newspapers and other media at the time. And people thought that was kind of amusing. So they started referring to Uncle Sam, and it got into especially political cartooning. And interestingly, not in America first, but in Britain, where they were trying to make fun of America often. And so they would draw this Uncle Sam character in cartoons like in Punch magazine to kind of make America look like a buffoon. And especially during the Civil War, that's really when Uncle Sam begins to, if anybody thinks about what Abraham Lincoln looks like, Uncle Sam begins to look more and more like Lincoln, this really tall, thin guy with a beard and, you know, a tall hat. So it's really in cartoons, especially often anti-American cartoons, that the image of Uncle Sam begins to get settled. Interestingly, and this is kind of a surprise to me until I thought about it, Uncle Sam tends to represent the American government, whereas Brother Jonathan tended to represent the American people. And so when we draw Uncle Sam, and we often draw him either, you know, really strong or kind of weak, you know, kind of, you know, sick, we tend to be referring to the government, not the people. And that's a really interesting, but real, I think, distinction.
True. Yeah. So when Uncle Sam was used for war recruiting posters, it's Uncle Sam wants you. The government is calling you to serve.
Absolutely. So you have him talking to the people, but he's not representing the people.
Yep. Let's talk about the American flag. The one thing I thought I knew about the flag was that Betsy Ross sewed the first flag. And that's almost certainly not the case. In fact, you say this is a case where we can actually trace the source who says it's the grandson, I believe, of Betsy Ross, who says, well, we don't know the source, so this tradition is as good as any, and essentially creates a tradition by fiat. Is that kind of how it happened?
Yeah, unfortunately, absolutely. The flag resolution, which specified some details about the flag very, very early in the American Revolution, was a year after the supposed Betsy Ross flag sewing. So it's almost impossible that she would have sewn the flag when we hadn't even adopted a flag at that point. Also, there's some record or there's some claim of the Continental Congress sending a committee to her, including George Washington. But George Washington wasn't a member of the Congress. He was a general of the army. So it's almost impossible he would have served on such a committee. So once again, you know, a myth. Yeah, it was probably a good generation later when, yeah, members of her own family were promoting this myth and saying, well, there's no evidence to support it, but in the absence of evidence, we can fall back on tradition, which is very circular thinking. You're trying to prove a tradition by referring to tradition, and historians really can't do that kind of thing.
And I was struck, you note that by the turn of the 19th century, America had 15 states, and there was some question, do we have 13 stars on the flag or 15? Do we have 13 stripes on the flag or 15? And you write that the flag that Francis Scott Key saw at Fort McHenry had 15 stars, but I believe 13 stripes. And it's interesting to go back and think that in that moment, there was the question of how changeable, how fluid is the design of this flag, which we think of as iconic and static.
Absolutely. In fact, I actually mentioned, and this was kind of a surprise to me too, we just assume that those 13 original stars and the 13 contemporary stripes refer to the 13 colonies. But there is evidence to suggest that that's not what the founders had in mind at all, that they may have been thinking about a constellation in the sky, specifically Lyra. And so there was no idea that they would add stars as they added states, because there wasn't an association between stars and states.
This is fascinating stuff. Once you start peeling away these layers, you just see all sorts of this stuff emerge. Let's talk about the Pledge of Allegiance. One thing that stood out to me is that there were various pledges, but you write that the one pledge that kind of stuck was written by a person who identified as a Christian socialist, and this was not unusual in the late 19th century. There was a strand of socialism that was blessed and championed by progressive Christians, but the person, Bellamy, there were two brothers. One of the brothers wrote the pledge as we know it. He was also known for a speech called Jesus the Socialist and Socialism and the Bible. And it just jumped out to me that as we're reciting the pledge today, do we have any idea that we're reciting the words of someone who called himself a Christian socialist?
Yeah, I can almost guarantee that we don't. obviously, once again, there's no such thing as a pledge in the Constitution. In fact, I even mentioned that pledging allegiance is kind of an unusual thing to do, not only cross-culturally, but for democracies. You know, the entire idea is that people are free to think and be and do what they want. And even America had no kind of loyalty oath until, again, that crisis moment, the Civil War. And loyalty oaths then were mostly directed to, you know, former Southern soldiers to make sure that they were, you know, coming back into the fold. And any Northern sympathizers, but just ordinary garden variety Americans weren't expected to pledge their allegiance, their loyalty, and certainly children were not.
Yeah, interesting. And again, to tie it back to the current moment where there's this conflict over is proper respect being paid to the national anthem and the flag at sporting events, as you say, that sort of conformity, that sort of concern about expressing loyalty like that happens in moments of conflict, of concern, when something is perceived to be under threat.
Absolutely. So the Civil War, it raises its ugly head again during the First World War, again during the Second World War, during the Cold War. Those are moments, obviously, when there literally are existential threats to the country. And so it becomes more and more important to guarantee that people, again, especially children, are going to be loyal and have that loyalty instilled deeply, deeply within them. So it's not even a point now of questioning it. They've just been raised with it.
Other holidays that you write about that I've got to ask you about, Mother's Day and Father's Day, you trace it back to at least the early 20th century, and it's notable that the woman who can be attested as the source, as the originator of Mother's Day, came to loathe the celebration of Mother's Day by the time of her death, I believe in the 1920s, you write. What was her problem with how Mother's Day had developed, and what would she make of Mother's Day today?
Anna Jarvis. Supposedly picking up a practice that her own mother, Ann Jarvis, had started to honor mothers, one day a year. Anna Jarvis ideally wanted, children, including adult children, to write letters to their mothers to express their love and their appreciation. She didn't want it to become all commercial. And when companies from flower companies to card companies began once again to appropriate that holiday, and to make it an occasion not to express your own, felt opinions, but to give her a printed version of somebody else's opinions, a la, a greeting card. She thought that the entire thing had simply gone off the rails, and she became the most vocal critic, actually tried to outlaw the holiday, but by that point it had gotten way out of her hands. And so she died, in poverty, to the last day, condemning the holiday that she had been so instrumental in starting in the first place.
And there were similar concerns about Father's Day. Let's just not let it get too commercial. And now if you see some of the ads on TV around those holidays today and the Hallmark greeting card industry, it took a different direction than they intended.
Oh, sure. And, Americans these days, bemoan Christmas and even Thanksgiving for becoming so commercial. And I'm sure you've noticed that we've already started the holiday shopping season. In fact, one thing I guess we didn't mention when we talked about Thanksgiving a few minutes ago was the settling of the date has a lot to do with creating a shopping season. And back in the 30s, when Roosevelt was president, then the Depression was still on. He tried to move the holiday a week earlier at the behest of the National Dry Goods Association. Thank you very much. To create a week longer shopping season. And about half the states followed him, the Democratic states, another interesting political divide, and the Republican states didn't. And so for two or three years, America was split over the date of Thanksgiving until they finally, under protest, settled back on the original date. But both Thanksgiving and Christmas and every other holiday, from Veterans Day to Washington's birthday, has become incredibly commercial.
And I'm wondering if in the next edition of your book you can add a chapter about Black Friday. And what we're seeing now, I think relatively recently, is the intrusion of Black Friday into Thanksgiving itself. So some of these sales start at midnight or at 6 p.m. or I think in some cases even at noon on Thanksgiving. And it's that inevitable intrusion of commercialization that, as you say, is foundational to the location of Thanksgiving on the calendar.
Well, absolutely. And an escalation, as you see. Yeah, just a battle to make it earlier and earlier. I didn't actually mention Black Friday, I realized later, but I guess there actually was something maybe as early as the 60s when people were referring to a Black Friday, or sometimes the Big Friday. But the actual Black Friday that we know and love is much more recent. And of course, even more recent, as people know, is Cyber Monday, which just shows once again how traditions keep being created. This ongoing process of tradition has not ended and never will end.
Yeah, a few more holidays to ask you about. You talk about St. Patrick's Day, Cinco de Mayo, and Kwanzaa as holidays that are and traditions that are, I don't know if I should say contrived or developed by immigrant populations with an appeal to countries outside the U.S., but in fact they are American originations that we in some cases export back to the foreign countries that to which they refer. Explain how that worked with St. Patrick's Day. There was a feast of St. Patrick in Ireland dating back many centuries, but St. Patrick's Day became what it became in America much more recently. How did that work?
Well, yeah, as you say, many of those holidays either refer back to some other country or do have a source of some sort there, but it's nothing like the tradition that actually we know and that was practiced in America. So there was, you know, for some centuries, a feast day for St. Patrick on the Catholic calendar. And I think it's really important for Americans to remember, and they forget very easily, that St. Patrick, like all saints, and all this wearing of the green business is not so much an Irish tradition as an Irish Catholic tradition. Green is the color of Catholics. Orange is the color of Protestants. And so many Irish Protestants would not, you know, join in the revelry here at all about this green, you know, saint business. But anyhow, even in the early 1800s, before the large immigration after the potato famine, Irish immigrants in America were celebrating St. Patrick's Day as actually kind of a day of assimilation to celebrate their pride in being Americans. So they would have quite sober evening indoor festivals. They would have, you know, dinners and speeches and things like that, usually kind of leading citizens, the upper class and businessmen, and they would display the Irish flag and the American flag. And they would essentially, again, you know, kind of establish, proclaim their Americanness. It's really only in the later 1800s when the next wave of immigrants who are poorer, more Catholic, and more militant, more anti-British, move in, take over this holiday from the kind of more stodgy establishment Irish leadership in America, have outdoor parades, more raucous kinds of events, and much more, again, kind of military events with, you know, kind of rifle associations marching. Much more, you know, stating of Irish pride and Irish nationalism, both against Britain and to a certain extent against America.
And when it comes to Cinco de Mayo, how did this emerge, and how do you determine is Cinco de Mayo American or something else or all of the above?
Well, I like the way you say that, all of the above, ultimately. The original event that it refers to, the Battle of Puebla, to set a little context, America had seized about a third of Mexican territory after the Mexican-American War in 1848. As a result of that war, Mexico was in debt and, you know, Europe was pretty angry at it. So a number of European countries were kind of looking at Mexico as, you know, a potential source of, you know, wealth and power. France actually invades Mexico, trying to establish a French empire there. And so the French army is met by a Mexican, much smaller Mexican army at Puebla, and miraculously the Mexicans win. Of course, they went on to lose the war. France did conquer Mexico and installed an emperor, Maximilian, for a few years during the American Civil War when America really couldn't do anything about it. So anyhow, there actually was a battle in Mexico. But it's kind of like, you know, the original Thanksgiving in New England. It was a small local affair. You know, it was not a national Mexican holiday. It's not Mexican Independence Day. It just so happened that the general, Zaragoza, of the Mexican army was born in Texas, Gilead, Texas, which was already American by that time. And so it's Mexican Americans, and remember, they didn't so much come to America as America came to them, suddenly surrounding, engulfing their territory. It's Mexican Americans in Texas and Southern California who, again, kind of select this date, the way Irish select St. Patrick's Day, to remember, you know, a great thing that Mexicans did, and to once again celebrate their national identity inside America.
And you write about Kwanzaa. It's interesting that its roots trace back to, or at least are associated with, the Black Power movement of the mid-20th century. And you note that kind of two strands have developed, a sort of more purist strand, and then there is the corporate embrace of Kwanzaa, where many corporations recognize it and try to celebrate it to some extent. Is the attempted mainstreaming of Kwanzaa, the corporatization, you might say, of Kwanzaa, is that a bastardization or is it a triumph that this holiday becomes mainstream? Or again, is it back to all of the above?
Yes. I mean, as anthropologists, we don't get into arguments about bastardization and such. I mean, once something, whether it's a tradition or a song or anything else, is put on the table, anyone can play.
Yep.
And so obviously, those who are using it for more African nationalist identity kind of purposes are going to want to control it and do certain things with it. Those who either see it as a wonderfully multicultural thing, or just see it as a, you know, sales opportunity, are going to think of it and use it in very different ways. And from at least from my point of view, neither one is more real, more authentic even than the other. They're just the multiple ways that people handle culture of all sorts, tradition and otherwise.
Yep. Well, you have chapters on Coca-Cola, a chapter on Superman, Mickey Mouse, a chapter on blue jeans. Let me ask you about that, because tradition does include dress, artifacts and means of dress, of clothing ourselves. You call blue jeans, I believe, an individualistic American uniform, if I have that right. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, Americans, you know, love to think of themselves as wonderfully individualistic and, you know, even iconoclastic, and yet we seem to do it, you know, in very much the same ways. So when you look at, you know, these, you know, spaces of individualism like college campuses or, you know, those urban streets, look down the street and what you see is a sea of, you know, blue denim. So Americans are individuals within very narrow ranges of conformity. And this is kind of, you know, our individualistic uniform, as I mentioned.
Well, you have a closing chapter where you kind of give some reflections, including how there's an anti-historical streak in American memory, in American culture. America is not particularly... it's not always captive to history. It's not always interested in history. You talk about how in the 19th century there was an attempt to tear down Independence Hall. And at the same time, you've traced how America clings and develops these stories and these rituals. Do you find those two things at odds, or perhaps does one lead to the other? How do you see that as an anthropologist? We are anti-historical, and yet we cling to and place a lot of investment in forming these traditions.
Well, I guess there is, it's interesting oxymoron in one way and another. It's kind of the natural progression of a society, of a country becoming mature. As I think most of your listeners will know, America, you know, if you think about the Revolution, the birth of the country, was born, you know, with a future orientation. The whole point was it was a new kind of society, a new world, you know, shaking off the shackles of tradition, which largely meant European culture. We were going to, you know, appeal to reason and not to history. So there was very much a sense of looking forward, not looking backward, and that history is, again, largely, you know, a trap. We don't want that kind of thing. I think that, and again, most Americans didn't worry about any of that kind of stuff for the first few decades, assuming that America would be just fine as individuals just pursue their, you know, individual rational interests. When you get those, as I call them, existential threats to the country, like the Civil War, immigration, socialism, Americans begin to realize a country can't live without, can't stay together without those kinds of things. And so America does this interesting kind of backward process. We tend to think, we social scientists, of society starting out traditional and becoming modern. If anything, America started out modern and became traditional. In this really aggressive process of creating traditions to try to create some kind of American identity, some kind of American unity. And so we see this, again, these decades between about 1880, which is when the Civil War veterans are becoming, you know, older adults and starting maybe even to die. They don't want that memory of their sacrifice and their accomplishments to be lost. And about 1920, coming out of World War I, that generation or so, really, really muscular traditioning to try to pull America together when it seems like it's just about to fall apart.
So that does a lot to answer my next question, but I want to ask it in these terms. Throughout this book, you're witnessing this battle between myth and fact, and trying to reconcile what we assume to be fact with what history actually shows. What if as an anthropologist, what is the value of that exercise? It's not just to say, oh, it was this date and not that date, or it wasn't Betsy Ross. What are you getting at as an anthropologist when you're trying to sort out what's true and what's not when it comes to myth?
Thank you for that question. That's actually a really important question for my discipline, and I think maybe for Americans and humans in general. I think the main message of anthropology and of this kind of revelation about traditioning is that the way things are today isn't the way they always have been. We think that the flag has always been thus and so, the song, and it's always meant the same things. People have always treated them the same way, and that's not true. Every behavior, every institution, every symbol has a history. And to understand how it's come makes us realize that we can't take the present and read it back into the past. But that also means that, and maybe that's kind of a sobering, even slightly depressing activity. But I think the more optimistic message from that is that we don't have to, we can't read the present into the future. That is, if things today aren't the way they always have been, they aren't the way they always have to be. And therefore, we can make the future differently and hopefully better than today because we created the past, we created the present, and we're going to create the future.
That's well stated and a timely message. Again, it's fun to peel back the layers on these things, and it starts out as a fun exercise, and it gets us quite quickly face to face with these serious themes. And you handle and bridge the transition from the trivial to the more serious very ably and very usefully in this book. So, Jack David Eller, the book is called Inventing American Tradition. It's brand new, hot off the presses. A fascinating work here. There's even more to explore. Maybe that's the final lesson of your book, is that these traditions are always in progress, and who knows what form and shape they'll take next and what new traditions will come along.
Thank you very much, Mike. Very great pleasure to share my book with you and with your audience today.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye.
Jack David Eller is the author of Inventing American Tradition, From the Mayflower to Cinco de Mayo, published this month by Reaction Books. Eller is a retired professor of anthropology at the Community College of Denver. His many books include Cultural Anthropology, Global Forces, Local Lives, and Culture and Diversity in the United States. I'm Nathan Bierma. You've been listening to the New Books Network.